From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, my transceiver, like most transceivers, has lots of knobs on the front of it. Not as many as some, but a fair number of knobs. And frankly, I don't really touch them all that much. I have the radio set up the way I like. It receives well, it transmits well, and I'm happy. But I know, in the back of my mind, that if I took the time to tweak, especially on the receive side, my AGC, my RF gain, I could probably get better performance out of it. Isn't that true?
That probably is, and I guess it depends on your style of operating and what you want to listen to. If you are listening to strong signals that are easy to copy, it probably doesn't make too much difference. The problem comes up when you try to listen to that weak signal. And one of the problems is, as with antennas, sometimes you don't hear anything at all and you think there's no signal there, so you don't realize you have a problem. So the signals you don't hear don't make you think you need to change something. It's the signals.
Oh, this is all just psychology then. Okay, yeah. Got it.
But the signals that you can barely hear can generally be improved by manipulating of those buttons and knobs.
Just run them all to 11, right?
That would be one approach. I would suggest a more thoughtful.
More nuanced.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, when you do that, you may find that you hear signals you hadn't heard before. So you actually may improve the performance to the extent that you actually can hear more signals. Now, there are a number of different categories to talk about. But the key thing that makes our newer radios different from ones we've had in the past is the capability of digital signal processing that's built into all of our new, I shouldn't say all, but most of our new radios, and even most of the ones of the previous generation had digital signal processing features. That's one part of it. And some other things that we'll talk about. But perhaps the most obvious one to think about is the received bandwidth.
Yes.
We've mentioned in the past that the received noise is directly proportional to the bandwidth, whereas the received signal doesn't need to have a bandwidth any wider than the bandwidth of the signal. So if you have the received bandwidth set to a wider bandwidth than needed, you won't get more signal, but you will get more noise, making the signal harder to copy. So that's, you know, many people think of selectivity as a interference rejection issue, which is what one thing it does very well, but it also improves signal-to-noise ratio. So for example, a toll quality, it's a phone company term, a telephone channel has a bandwidth of 3,000 hertz and extends from 300 to 3,300 hertz. This is what the phone company agrees to provide you, or at least used to when they were regulated.
Yes.
And while it can handle speech communication, at least for older men, it is far from high fidelity. It won't do a good job with your violin, but we aren't allowed to do that anyway. It also doesn't do very well with your grandchildren, people have found.
But I've noticed that.
I guess the bearded men at Bell Labs who set this up didn't have their grandchildren with them at the time, so they didn't think about that, I think. But anyway, interestingly, the early Collins SSB filters from the 50s started out at 3,100 hertz, kind of matching that standard, I think. That's probably where they got it from. But over time, they realized that bandwidth as narrow as 2,100 hertz, perhaps, can do a good job transmitting communication quality voice, and at the same time got rid of about 50% of the noise. Now, current transceivers typically or often have bandwidths adjustable at each end of the range in increments as small as 50 hertz. So you can tailor that to as narrow a bandwidth as you can still understand the person comfortably working in from either end, both getting rid of interference on either side of the signal as well as reducing noise until you have the optimum signal-to-noise ratio that you can get. And it's actually signal-to-noise and signal-to-interference because you're eliminating both, depending on what you're up against, as you move the selectivity in from each end of the signal. So that's one thing to do, and that's very straightforward. You know, if you're listening to somebody who's in the clear, no interference, and armchair copy, no reason not to open that up to 3 or 4 kilohertz, even if the person has got voice components out there. Some people transmit a wider single sideband signal than others. So there's no reason not to use more bandwidth if you are having no trouble copying. But if you are having trouble reduce the bandwidth until it starts to make the audio not sound easy to copy. That's one thing.
What about CW in that regard?
Well, exactly the same thing. For CW, you can actually reduce the bandwidth down to as low as perhaps 50 hertz. Now, if you think about that, that's a factor of 75 or something in terms of getting rid of 75 mm-hmm. times or 75 times improvement in the signal noise ratio of listening to them in a single sideband filter. There are two problems with that you have to be aware of. One is, as you narrow the bandwidth, the tuning becomes very critical. So if you're not careful, you can narrow the bandwidth until you have moved it to where you can't hear the signal anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful what you're doing. Also, if you are tuning, looking for a signal, if you have a very narrow bandwidth, you have to tune very slowly. Otherwise, you go right by it. If you happen to go past that signal while he has the key up, there'll
That's
be nothing
right.
there. So very critical trade-off there. So in most cases, you're best tuning with a wider bandwidth and then slowly reducing the bandwidth to improve the signal-to-noise ratio and get rid of interference until you have the signal optimized. And then hope neither you nor the other station drifts.
Well, now, my transceiver has adjustable IFDSP bandwidth,
right.
Receive bandwidth. Mm-hmm. When I make it extremely tight on a CW signal, I hear an unusual...
Yes, you can get artifacts from DSP, and you have to kind of watch that. If the artifacts are annoying, and sometimes what you get is what's called ringing, in which the very narrow pulse of the CW signal causes the filter to oscillate or ring, so it kind of fills in the space between dots, for example. Well, that's not good either. So you have to be wide enough so that you aren't having any artifacts that interfere with your reception. And some radios are better than others, and the DSP is not like our old crystal filters. It's something that people wrote in software, and they loaded into the machine, and maybe one company's software is better at one thing, and another company's is mm-hmm. better at something else. So they're not all the same, and you can't go to the same level of bandwidth with every one. If you're a real CW fan, though, it might be worth your while when you're evaluating a receiver to see what a signal sounds like at a 50 hertz bandwidth.
Yes.
Or, you know, but oftentimes 100 hertz is, it's twice as big, but it's still a much smaller fraction of the sideband bandwidth, so it's not a bad trade. But the point is, go as low as you can such that you can hear the station well and find the station.
Yes.
And get rid of other people. So I often use a bandwidth for casual operating between 250 and 750 hertz. With interference, I'll drop it down to 50 or 100 hertz, mm-hmm. but being very careful to make sure I have the station in the middle of that bandwidth. And some receivers have an automatic tuning feature that helps you keep it there, which is kind of nice. But again, you have to be careful that if you have interference, that it doesn't latch on to the neighbor signal.
That's right.
And tune it off the one you want to listen to. So all of a sudden, you're listening to the other guy, and you didn't mean to. Now, another key parameter is the RF gain.
Ah, yes.
And when I say RF gain, I mean it sort of in lowercase, in the sense that it's not just the RF gain control, but often you have an attenuator and a preamp as well. All of these things affect the RF gain in somewhat similar ways. But in general, increasing the RF gain with any of these increases the signal, but it also increases the noise.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
That's absolutely true. In addition to too much gain, when there are high-level signals around, if not on your frequency, you can generate intermodulation products within your receiver, resulting in blocking new signals that aren't even there. And an interesting fact, especially for DXers and contesters who need to deal with lots of strong signals, adding 10 decibels of attenuation with your attenuator will reduce the desired signal by 10 dB, as you would expect. But a lot of people don't know that by doing that, you also reduce the third-order intermod signals, the products of close-in strong signals landing on your frequency, by 3 times that, or 30 dB.
I've noticed that myself.
By using low RF gain, you actually improve your dynamic range, assuming the signals are strong enough to hear. So if you can hear somebody with your preamp turned off and your attenuator turned on and copy them well, you're much better off than cranking it all up and then backing off the gain control someplace else in the system, because that'll eliminate these signals that are causing you intermod products. So my rule of thumb is to not use the preamp on any bands below 20 meters, and I mean lower in frequency, and sometimes not even there. 20 meters and lower are usually limited by the atmospheric noise. So adding gain increases the signals and noise together and doesn't give you an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio.
No, it wouldn't.
If the bands are crowded with strong signals, add some attenuation and see if you can still hear the signal you want. That will help even more. On higher bands, you're more likely to be limited by noise in the receiver. coming up to the level of atmospheric noise. So adding a preamp to bring your signals up ahead of the receiver will improve your signal-to-noise ratio. And this is almost always the case on 10 meters, frequently on 15 meters, 10 and 6 meters, frequently on 15 meters, and occasionally on 20 meters. But as you increase the gain and add your preamp in, watch out for those intermod signals showing up. So another thing, some people with some radios find that by turning their RF gain control all the way up towards the high end, it seems to bring up the noise faster than the signals. And many people say that there's kind of a sweet spot at maybe two-thirds of the way up where the signals are strong, but the noise hasn't come up as far. And that's one you'll have to try out on your personal receiver to see what happens. But all of these things are dependent on the atmospheric conditions at the time, signal strengths, band conditions, and so forth. So this is a reason for not keeping all the buttons in the same place. You really need to kind of adjust these depending on the conditions you're in and deal with all of those controls, the RF gain, the attenuation, and whether the preamp is on or off, or how sometimes you have two preamps. But use my rule of thumb. If it's 20 meters and lower frequencies, start with the preamp turned off and see if it works. If it does, don't turn it on unless you absolutely need it.
Let's take a break for DX Engineering, Joel, and we'll have two more parameters I want to talk about.
All right.
And we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime, and we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, just in time to talk about automatic gain control.
All right. Well, that's an interesting topic because you would think since it's automatic, you wouldn't have to do much about
That's right.
And for many years, the choices were few, that the automatic gain control could be turned on or it could be turned off.
That was it.
That was it. And that was a pretty easy to make. If the signals blew out your eardrums when they came in loud, you'd turn on the AGC to cut them back. And in most cases in the old days, AGC didn't even work on CW. It only worked on AM phone. Nowadays, we have much more sophisticated systems. And in some cases, you have many different parameters that you can adjust. The basic idea of AGC is to reduce receiver gain in the presence of strong signals to keep your audio level relatively constant. And this is good for protecting your ears because usually signals are of different amplitudes.
Yeah, otherwise it's highly annoying too.
That's true, in addition to going deaf. Modern AGC systems can work with any modes by responding quickly to a strong signal and then holding the gain based on the peak level. The earlier AGC systems just operated on the carrier of an AM signal. And of course, we don't have that most of the time anymore with single sideband or CW. There is no carrier. So nowadays, what we do is the AGC responds quickly to the peaks of a signal, and then assuming the signal stays at about the same length, it holds the level there for a time and slowly drops off. And usually that's adjustable. You can usually all modes have fast attack. That is, they quickly respond to the signal strength to keep from having your ears blown. But the falling off of the AGC, the decay, can be set to fast, medium, and slow in many cases.
And many times between those
yes,
values.
Yes, and in some radios you have a continuum times. And generally, you want a fast decay for CW, medium for single sideband, and slow for AM or casual SSB. The reason for that is, as you're tuning a CW, tuning across the CW band, if you have the AGC set for a slow decay, you'll come across a strong signal. It will set the AGC, and you keep tuning. And the next signal you come across is not strong, but the gain is still reduced from the first one, and you don't hear the second one. So for CW, you want that signal to that AGC to drop off quickly, the gain to come back up, so you can start over again with the next signal and set the gain properly. So that's fairly straightforward. For single sideband, you don't want the AGC to respond to every syllable. Otherwise, they get noise in between syllables as the gain increases and so forth. So you have kind of a medium speed. And then for AM, typically you can have it set for slow, and it just sits there and at the carrier level.
I know for digital operating, fast AGC response is recommended for the same reason that you described for CW, really.
Yes, I think that's good because you want to be able to have it respond to whatever is happening. Digital modes don't have as much, let's start another way. The analog modes, you do the signal processing really in your head.
Yes.
And in a digital mode, the software that's looking at your sound card is what's doing the processing. And you want to have the tones a relatively equal volume so it can decide which tone or which phase it has. And by responding quickly to changes in fading or whatever, you can maintain a relatively steady input stream to the processing, where the processing is happening. There are other AGC parameters that are important. There's the threshold at which AGC starts operating. This is a fairly subtle one in a way. Every receiver has background noise. And what you want to do is you don't want to have the AGC start to reduce gain because of background noise. You want to have it start to reduce gain just because of strong signals. But on a different band, you may have higher levels of noise than another. So if the threshold is set for one band where you have a very low noise level and you can hear very weak signals, and then you go to another band where the noise level is high, you can have the gain reduced just by the noise that's there, and that will reduce your sensitivity. So you won't hear those weak signals. So it's important. Some radios have an adjustment for that and some don't. But check it out and look and see what your situation is. And if you do have an adjustable threshold and you want optimum performance, you almost have to change that day by day, day to night, depending on what the noise level is, because you don't want the gain to be reduced until the signals are above the noise level.
Assuming your transceiver has such a control, is there ever a time that you would want the AGC off?
Well, if it's set properly, I would argue no. But if you don't want to have the AGC doing anything negative to you, you can turn the AGC off and just watch your ears.
Yes.
In case you hit somebody that's very strong. And the one other parameter that some AGC systems have an adjustment for is the slope. You might think an ideal situation would be a totally flat slope. That is to say, no matter what level the signal is, they all come out at the same level in your ears so that the AGC is adjusting the gain so everybody comes out equally. That can be comfortable, but sometimes it's nice to know that one signal is stronger than the other. And if you have a slope set, a stronger signal comes out sounding a little stronger. It allows you to have a better appreciation for, well, let's say swinging your beam or whatever else to maximize the signal. It gives you a better sense of what's happening on the band, I guess, and where the conditions are good and so forth. So that's pretty much a personal preference kind of thing. So you can, if you adjust the slope so it's a gradual slope, then you can sort of tell who's stronger than another. So if you're talking in a round table, and then you can say, oh, well, Sam is a little stronger than Sally today and whatnot without having to look at your meter. Although, why wouldn't you want to look at your meter? I don't know. Anyway, but you have that choice. I guess having a choice is never a bad idea. So I think those are the main things that I think about in optimizing a receiver's performance. Selectivity, gain setting, and AGC setting. And with those, I think you setting those up properly will give you the best performance you can get.
Assuming that your radio has such a control, what about the IF shift? Do we need to talk about that?
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, that's a good point. And that's kind of similar when we're talking about setting the bandwidth, and you can set it from the low to the high separately. That's almost the same thing. In other words, you can take your, let's say you've settled on a 2.1 kilohertz bandwidth sideband filter, and you have interference moving in from the low end. You can slide that up towards the high end a little bit and lop off the interfering signal at the cost of losing a little bit of the low end of your signal, which is sometimes a good trade. So that's IF shift allows that kind of arrangement. And you get the same effect by adjusting the low end and the high end separately. Many radios have a choice of which one you can do. You can either have a width and a shift, or you can have a low end and a high end adjustment. And they both can have the same effect when you're done.
Now, throughout our whole podcast here, really, we've been talking primarily with analog transceivers in mind. What about software-defined radios? I mean, of course, many of the parameters we've been talking about are adjustable there as well. Bandwidth, RF gain, yep. Preamps on and off, that kind of thing. Are there any differences, really?
I'm just off the top of my head, I can't think of anything offhand, because if you think about it, all the things we've been talking about pretty much, are things that happen in the digital processing side of a modern receiver. And that's really a very similar to a software-defined receiver. It is, really. So sometimes the front end is different in how the signals get there, and the digital part is moving closer and closer to the antenna with each new generation of radios, as we've seen. But the processing part that happens at the back end, largely, is still about the same. And each manufacturer has a little different idea of what the best way is to do it. But I think the same kinds of things are available in both.
Yes.
Because really the circuitry is almost the same once you get to where the processing's done.
Yeah, ultimately, it's the same, really.
Yeah.
Well, how about a question? Are you ready?
I could do a question.
Well, here's an appropriate one from Rich, K3SOM. And he asks, I have a set of commercial bandpass filters and seem to be having trouble with the 40-meter unit blowing out its capacitors, so I've decided to attempt to build my own. In a search of the internet, I came across an Ed Weatherhold N3NQN design for some bandpass filters that looked like they would be superior to my old filters in many regards. My question is, just what is a quadrifiliar winding and how do I wind it? I have an antenna analyzer as well as other instruments available. Can you help by explaining how these are constructed and how the windings are connected?
I could try to do that. It would be easier with a blackboard probably,
yes.
But I don't draw very well anyway. So quadrifiler is a lot like bifiler, if you're familiar with that, but that's not really answering the question. A bifiler winding, to start there, is a winding with two wires. When you think of a transform, let's say picture a toroidal coil core and a two-winding transformer. One way to do it would be to take one wire and wind it around the core, and then take the second wire, the secondary, let's say, and wind it around the core and have them both occupying different segments of the core. Fairly straightforward. The pictures often look like that. And that can work, and it's often done. If we wanted to make the same kind of a transformer using bifiler windings, what we would do is we would take the two wires together as a pair and wind them on the core so that each wire is sort of intermixed with the other as they go. So if you picture, one way to picture that is to picture using zip cord or a Radio Shack speaker wire or something like that that has two wires stuck together and just making the transformer that way. So you've got two separate windings, but they're both occupying the same segment of the core. And I guess that has some advantages in terms of properties of the transformer. A quadrifiler, which is used in this, the Weatherhold filter, is the same idea, except you use four wires. Now, the chances are you can't find four wires that are all glued together. So the trick with doing this is to keep track of which wire is which, because after a while, you sort of lose touch. The optimum way to do this is to have four spools of wire of different colors, let's say, and that makes it pretty easy, and you wind them all together, and when you're done, you cut off each wire. If you can't do that, another thing you can do is take one wire, wind the number of turns so you see how long it has to be, cut it off, then cut three other wires the same length. And now the question is, how do you tell them apart? Well, one way to do that is to take your marking pen and either put different color marks at each end of, or put the same color marks at each end of each wire so you can tell one wire from the other, or perhaps put one stripe on one wire at each end, two stripes on another, and so forth. Or maybe even no stripes on one wire. Although that's always risky because you say, gee, did I wipe that off or is that... But anyway, that's all a quadrifiler winding is. And the only trick is keeping track of which wire is which and which end is which and so forth. But if you're careful and do it properly, it should work just fine. And usually you try to do it in such a way that they don't overlap each other but stay next to each other as they're wound around the core. By the way, those filters are classic designs, the Weatherhold filters. They were described in a two-part article series in May and June of 1998 in QST, and they are used at W1AW, which has a lot of band-to-band problems between radios since they operate high-power stations on all HF bands at the same time, pretty much. And they are also used at many multi-transmitter contest stations and so forth. It's also possible to go back with your other thing and find a similar rated capacitor that's blowing out and find one with a higher voltage rating, and chances are it'll work. But starting over would be fun, and you may enjoy the experience.
Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.